Resource Committee, oh, excuse me, Resource Committee meeting of March 19th to order. It's 3:32. Present today, myself, Co-Chair Wagoner, Co-Chair Passavant. Members are Senator Wilikowski, Senator French, Senator McGuire, Senator Stevens. At this time, first bill we're going to take up today is Senate Bill 159, Susitna State Forest. This bill has been before the committee a couple of times. It's had public hearings. And at this time, I'd like to ask a motion for a new CS, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd move that we bring the CS for Senate Bill 159, identified as version /D, before this committee for purposes of discussion.
I'll object for discussion purposes. Senator Menard, would you like to present the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Linda Menard. I'm representing Senate G. Thank you again. This CS makes two changes from the original bill. It exempts private inholdings that lie within the proposed forest boundaries, thereby excluding them from being included in the forest. Secondly, the CS adds on page 31 the intent language that Senator Stedman spoke to during Monday's meeting and that I support including. I should note that the exclusions and all the legal land descriptions in the CS have been double-checked by forestry, the Division of Land, Mining, and Water, and both agencies have approved. Rick Jandro, the resource forester from Coastal Region, and Chris Mesh, the state forester, is online if you have any questions. If not, that concludes my testimony on the CS. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. I'd also like the record to reflect that Senator Kathy Geisel is in the audience. Is there any other senators or representatives? I don't see it.
Senator Millett.
Oh, Representative Millett's here.
Senator Thomas.
Where's Joe?
Right behind her.
Oh, and Senator Thomas. You got Thomas Wagoner here, yeah. Okay. With that, thank you, Senator Menard. Is there any questions of Senator Menard? Senator French.
Section 2 of the bill on page 31, is that a new part?
I'm sorry, I have the M here.
Which version are we on?
D is in David.
Yeah, D is, okay, I thought so.
You know, that's the amendment that Senator Stedman wanted in the bill.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk about it, please?
I'll defer to Michael here. That's been my chief of staff, Michael Rivito, who's been working with the Division of Forestry and Water and Mine. And
sure. For the record, Michael Rivito, staff to Senator Linda Menard. Through the chair, Senator French, that Section 2 came about on Monday's meeting when Senator Stedman had mentioned his desire to obtain more of the Tonga State Forest into the state's possession. And this, through that committee conversation and then the conversation that Senator Stedman and Senator Menard had following the committee, they determined that strong intent language, urging the governor to take either one of two approaches to doing so would be appropriate to add on to this bill, just expressing the desire of the legislature to see more of this land come into state ownership. So that was the impetus of Section 2.
And just one quick follow-up.
Senator French.
I understand lines 23 about negotiating or renegotiate land entitlements, but on lines 24 and 25, we're asking that the governor work to amend the Alaska Statehood Act. Has that ever been done?
Through the chair to Senator French, I don't think I can answer that question accurately. I could certainly find out.
It seemed like the federal government will do whatever they want to with the Alaska Statehood Act, so why shouldn't we? I mean, that's my response to that question.
I don't want to hold the bill up. I'm just curious to see whether the state of Texas.
But that is a good question.
Senator French, if I may, through the chair to Senator French, you remember, too, when we recently, as early as last week, met with Representative Don Young, he spoke to the Tongas as well and his frustration. So this really does put some intent language in the bill that to pay attention and try to get more a land designated in the Tongass. Do you remember that conversation?
I do remember that.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Senator Menard? Hearing no questions, I'll withdraw my objection at this time. Ask for a motion to move the bill from committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill 159 from this committee to the next committee or referral to individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, bill move.
I properly thank the chairman and the members of the committee.
You're welcome. We'll take a short break.
Call the Senate Resources Committee back to order. We now have before us Senate Bill 215. Senator Thomas. Mr. Hopkins, so if the two of you would please identify yourself. And this is an important bill that's coming before the legislature at this time that deals with the construction of a pipeline heading north from Cook Inlet to Fairbanks to carry natural gas as a potential energy solution to interior Alaska. So, Senator Thomas, please identify yourself, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senator Thomas, District D, which is primarily made up of a large portion of the Fairbanks North Star Borough as well as the entire Denali Borough. We've studied these routes, various routes, for quite some time, and in particular, we've studied a route between Fairbanks, or the interior anyhow, and Cook Inlet, or at least the existing infrastructure north of Cook Inlet. I remember when I was first elected, one of the first summers, I believe, after being elected, we went out and drove the route from Prudhoe all the way into to Fairbanks, and of course, that was NSTAR, accompanied by some state folks, as well as some various legislators, were on that trip. ANGDA has studied those routes, that particular route as well, and also the ASAP pipeline group as the southern end of the in-state gas line. That's basically the route that they have identified as the most beneficial, and also as a spur for the AGEA line, depending on what takes place with AGEA. The southern route using the Parks Highway is preferred route for all of those folks at this point in time. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're just trying to move forward a project that has been studied and is a very feasible project to move move gas into the interior. The route is part of whichever pipeline you talk about at this point in time, and it's getting to the point where there's been lots of study and lots of talk, and it's time to actually try to take some action. Cook Inlet could have as much as 19 TCF of gas, and I know that there is a great anticipation of the results of that, of those particular wells being drilled there, particularly looking forward to this summer season or this drilling season when the jackup rigs will both be in operation, we're hoping, in Cook Inlet, and further the delineation of what exists there. Any market for the Cook Inlet gas will increase the economics for that particular development. So certainly having gas moved out of the Cook Inlet area and moved north to the interior for potential use in that area as well as other potential is certainly advantageous. It is the shortest route from existing infrastructure to the interior of Alaska and could connect up with a line from the North Slope in the future. That's what many have proposed, is that you build the southern end of the line, and then at a later date, depending on what goes on with any bigger line or any line coming from the Prudhoe Bay, would be a leg then, obviously, into the Cook Inlet area. Obviously, the overall price tag is shorter at moving forward with the smaller line, and, in fact, knowing that we'll know by the fall, I'm sure, of this coming year, just how much gas there is in Cook Inlet, which is certainly a good step forward. As the ASAP pipeline moves forward, it seems reasonable to build a southern section first, as that portion would be used regardless of the AGEA line or any other line that goes into use. SB 215 does not stop the in-state line. It's just the first half of that, which could easily be extended onto the North Slope at any time at a later date. So it's not an either-or situation. The southern portion will also increase the opportunity for carrier gas exploration and development to the interior basins that have been known and explored to some degree for decades. This route would also reduce costs of other natural resource development in the south central, upper Kuskokwim, and interior regions of the state. We always talk about public-private partnerships. There's probably an opportunity to extend this line off towards the Donlin Creek mine, which is the Donlin Creek folks are talking about building their own line. That may be the way that ends up, but it may well be that there's a partnership to be formed there because that goes through some also very realistic mining area just to the west of the Susitna River in the mountains there. There are several large finds in that area. It is past the time to continue studying pipelines and roads to enhance development of Alaska's resources and build something. We've been studying this pipeline or a pipeline from the North Slope since 1959. I think of the headline in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner says gas is imminent, but certainly not imminent because here we are 50-some years later. So anyhow, Senate Bill 215 is part of a long-term affordable energy solution for the interior Alaska and benefits others. Areas that could use natural gas in the future. We've got a variety of other things on the table, but this is the most practical. It's not a short-term solution unless we get with it, but it would be at least a medium solution to the interior and also some other areas that could branch off from there. There's been a lot of talk about trucking gas into Fairbanks. If the pipeline were built, we would still truck gas to a variety of other areas there. They've shown a great deal of interest. And I encourage the Resources Committee to move this important piece of legislation forward. Realistically, the southern end of the pipeline should have a dramatic reduction in the cost per mile as the materials, the pipe, all the equipment, gravel, and all supplies would be delivered by rail and or paved road. Much different cost per mile than simply taking what the northern line would be. What the entire ASAP line would be and coming up with a cost per mile and saying that would be it because we dramatically reduce costs when you work off of existing pads and roads and with the railroad delivering materials where you don't have to transfer materials from rail barges and things like that. So it would be very advantageous for this project. And with that, I would answer any questions, and my aide, Greer Hopkins, is here to add a few things to it and a few specifics. And answer any questions as well.
Senator Wagner has a question.
No question, just kind of a statement. You might add one other thing to your presentation eventually, Joe. If this pipeline is built, it also enhances the ability, if there's gas found in the interior and it's the surplus generated by that find, such as in Nana Basin, it'll be a way to export some of that gas out to a commercial purpose too.
Correct. You mean to export coke inlet gas?
Pipeline runs both ways.
That's right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Any other? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you for bringing this forward. I when I saw it, I wanted to sign on as quick as possible, and I think it's a great bill for a few reasons. And this was actually an idea that was brought up a few years ago, and at the time I think many were concerned that it wasn't practical because we didn't believe we had as much gas in Cook Inlet as we now think we do with 19 trillion cubic feet, just an enormous amount of gas in Cook Inlet. I think this bill helps Fairbanks, obviously. It's a much cheaper alternative. It's to build it to Fairbanks than from Prudhoe Bay down to Fairbanks. But it's also going to help Cook Inlet. It's going to help the people in my community because it will increase exploration. One of the things that we've heard as a reason for why there hasn't been more exploration over the years in Cook Inlet is because if you find a huge find, you have nowhere to ship it. It's just the market's essentially stranded. And so this opens up a whole new market. In the event you get a big pipeline, you now have a line going where the big pipeline is going right by. So if or when that happens, you have access to that large line. if we ever do get a big line, you can, in the alternative, reverse the line and start shipping down Anchorage if we need it down here. So just from my opinion, this is just a much better alternative to go. The question I had for you was, what size do you anticipate? How many million or billion cubic feet do you estimate building this line?
We anticipated, thank you for the question, through the chair, we anticipated that it would be either a 20-inch line or a 24-inch line based on what ANGDA has studied and what ASAP pipeline folks have studied, as well as what NSTAR looked at initially.
And that would be capable of carrying a couple hundred MCF, 500 MCF?
Yeah, it would be capable of carrying 500 MCF and probably more depending on the compressors. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Hopkins. Senator Stevens has a question.
Sure. Just while we're talking about this, can you give us an idea of the distance we're talking about of the southern portion and also of the northern portion and a comparison in cost, if such a thing is available?
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Through the chair, the mileage is about 300 depending on which estimates you use, 350 to 365 miles, depending on, there's some indication that the Aegea spur to Anchorage would be about 365 miles, but if you're talking about just getting into Fairbanks from existing infrastructure, you're talking more in the line of about 335 miles. And there are various figures, but I think that the figures at this point in time are not necessarily refined. They're more of a cost per mile for the entire 720-odd miles of the pipeline from Prudhoe to mile 39, as it's referred to by Wasilla there, Big Lake. And I think that the number could be further refined, obviously, as you would take out a bunch of the cost, obviously, of compressor stations on the northern end and the conditioning plant and a variety of other things, and you factor in much easier route compared to anything that's north of the river. So that's why I believe that some of the numbers that have been come up was about $1.3 to $2 billion, but I think that those numbers could be further refined and come up with a much more realistic number, probably more in the range of $1 billion, $1.25 billion.
Thank you. Senator Wagner.
Just real quick, I don't think you, with Cook Inlet gas, we got really good gas. I don't think you're going to need a conditioning plant.
No, you won't. You won't. That's right. Correct.
That's a huge savings versus North Slope gas to Fairbanks.
Yeah, it's a couple of billion dollars. Yeah. And then you don't need the straddle plant either, because it's a straddle plant that has to strip out the dry stuff from the wet stuff. So it's a couple of billion dollars savings. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Mr. Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Friar Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas. Along those same numbers, the gas treatment facility on the North Slope was $1.84 billion, estimated by the AGDC. That would be taken off the books. Obviously, the pipeline from the North Slope to Dunbar would be off the books. until a later date if they decided to build the pipeline the rest of the way up, if that's the route that became most feasible in the future. The Fairbanks straddle plant was $280 million, and all those costs would not have to come into play right now, especially the gas treatment plant and the straddle plant, which don't get gas 1 inch closer to market or to anybody else. It's just the necessary infrastructure. As Senator Wagner said, the gas in Cook Inlet is substantially cleaner and drier. Along those same notes, Senator French, you'd asked about the capacity of what could be used in Fairbanks, and AGDC and the recently published preliminary distribution report for the Fairbanks area was both came in right about 60 million cubic feet per day, with a total of 20 billion cubic feet over the course of a year, and those could be supplied by a 12-inch line, but if we're going to be needing to build the second half of the line from the North Slope down in the future, it would make sense to build that slightly larger to carry more capacity, I believe. Additionally, the spur line, as Senator Thomas said, would work well trying to bring in any GSI's line or a 3 or 4 BCF line that comes to either Canada or Tidewater. We'd like to build that to get that gas to Cook Inlet, so this would get that done ahead of time. That 60 million cubic feet of gas that would be used in Fairbanks would be approximately a 25% increase in the market for what's used in Cook Inlet, if I remember correctly. That, of course, is not immediately what Fairbanks would be able to use. That would be about 10 years worth of distribution built out in Fairbanks. But if we're able to get that gas trucking project going, we can start using more gas in Fairbanks, then that could help the economy of the entire project once this is built into the future, with hopefully a shortened timeline also. The cost of energy in Fairbanks, if you look in your bill packet, even if gas is delivered at cost today, which is $23 per million cubic feet, that's a savings of Fairbanks for $114 million a year. So even if gas is exactly as expensive as it is up there, it'd be a substantial savings for many, many in the community overheating with diesel fuel, which is, of course, substantially more expensive. In addition to that, bringing a sizable amount of gas to Fairbanks at even the same cost, as I said before, would help our air quality up there substantially. You've all heard about the PM2.5 problem coming from mostly wood stove use when electricity and oil prices increase. It's not necessarily the savings that the EPA would really like to see, but the large steps taken by the state and the investment in getting that cleaner burning fuel to Fairbanks is what the EPA likes to see. I've heard a pretty good analogy. Los Angeles is never going to clean up their air all the way, but they're continuing to make steps in the right direction, and that's what the EPA likes to see. So taking a large step like this, which is the hopefully a longer term part of an energy plan at Fairbanks, would hopefully push back the penalties we have to getting our air cleaned up and make it so the state can keep its what will be limited transportation dollars in the future. As Senator Thomas said, it's not quite an either-or proposal at all. And we do have Mr. Sackett here today, who's able to talk about bringing the Nenana Basin gas online. He works on behalf of Doyon. I can't remember how to pronounce his company, but he's here today to talk about that exactly, and could talk about how that could go to market and what you were talking about before, Senator Wagner. And I'm, of course, available for any questions.
You know, one of the key considerations that I think that this committee should keep in mind is that the construction of a pipeline heading north from Big Lake to interior Alaska would create a energy distribution system with storage in place, which is, you know, we've seen that being constructed down in the Kenai right now. But it would create this energy distribution system with storage coming from the Kenai, going to South Central, and then heading all the way to the interior. So you have a significant portion of the Alaska's population that would be on this energy distribution system of natural gas. And from my personal belief, you know, that certainly there should be an export of natural gas to Alaskans in the interior before Alaska's resources are sent overseas. You know, who should best benefit from Alaska's natural gas other than Alaskans first? So I think that that is a significant upside potential for this. Certainly with the USGS increase in likely discoverable natural gas at 19 TCF within the last year, optimism should run high. And as Senator Wagner appropriately indicated, not only does it provide for the incentive to the Nanana Basin, for example, but certainly it does provide incentives for exploration in the Cook Inlet because it does expand the market for this energy distribution system. But so I think this is a good idea that should gain traction, and let's see where it goes. Any questions for Senator Thomas or Mr. Hopkins? Seeing none, we were not going to open public testimony today, but I've been informed that Mr. Green traveled down from Fairbanks. So rather than him travel down, anyway, Mr. Green, Richard, if you would please come forward. We will, just for purposes of the record, we will be officially opening public testimony at a later hearing. We were going to get the bill before the committee, but Mr. Green.
I didn't break the chair. I can't give you some glue and some good wood.
You'd think we could afford a new chair, wouldn't you?
There we go.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, so Mr. Green, please identify yourself.
My name is Richard Green. I'm live at 108 Wilderness Drive, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm down here for a different purpose, actually, the weatherization program. But just a little bit ago, I had the opportunity to pay my most recent fuel bill via my charge card over the phone. And I thought, what the heck? So I'm here. We're talking about Fairbanks Energy. I'm in the mood to testify about, the poor folks in Fairbanks. And I think I somewhat speak for a lot of us up there is, we all appreciate the due diligence you folks are doing down here, and you're being good stewards of our resources and everything. But, you know, we need to get some relief in Fairbanks. And I'm not going to go through all the examples. I manage a very large lumber yard there. The bills for my utilities and my branch, my store, it would knock your socks off. My own personal, I have a 5-star-plus house, high energy bills there, too. It's just, I just wanted to say, it's time to do something, and you guys know that, but I feel like we're kind of up in Fairbanks. We're kind of frogs in the water, and the heat's been being turned up, but the heat's not being turned up for us. The heat's being turned down, and we're not going to boil to death. We're going to freeze blocks of ice around our feet. So I just hope you guys keep moving forward. Thank you what you're doing, and carry on.
Any questions for Mr. Green, Senator Wagner?
You can't come before this committee and talk about high energy prices and not tell us what your 5-star house is costing.
My 5-star house, I have about 3,000 square feet. It cost me it was first built. It's 5.3 gallons a day average. And so that's about 2,000 gallons a year in fuel. And so at $4 a gallon, $5 a gallon, you do the math, I work good with zeros. And, you know, I'm fortunate. I have a good job and things go well. But for these folks out there and with the weatherization program and things like that, that the folks are a lot of folks are hurting up there. Let me just say that. And we can't lose sight of that. We're all part of the same big state. As much as the thought of having given Anchorage an opportunity to have their foot on something to go into Fairbanks, that's the Fairbanks-Anchorage competition all the time. That sounds like a good thing to do, but whatever you do, just time to do something. That's the bottom line, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. For purposes of the record, to purchase 1,000 gallons of fuel at $4 a gallon is about $4,000. To get the comparable BTUs with natural gas under the pricing in South Central Alaska right now is a little under $1,400. So it's a difference for a BTU equivalency of a little under $1,400 and $4,000, again, if one uses that 1,000 gallons as a base. We also have, my understanding, Senator Thomas, Mr. Jim Sackett from Togatilli Corporation from Nanana, Alaska, and since he was in town with the potential for Nanana Basin exploration, we figured we'd give Togatilli Corporation, Mr. Sackett a potential. So please identify yourself,
Thank you, Mr. Sackett. Chairman. My name is Jim Sackett. I'm the CEO President of Tagatili Corporation. It's the ANC located in Enana. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 215. We are in need of a mechanism for moving energy either to or from interior Alaska. And my understanding is Senate Bill 215 will do that. So I just wanted to weigh in real quick and say anything that will bring gas to or from the interior, we're all for. And you guys all know the reasons.
Any questions for Mr. Sackett? Seeing none, thank you for
Mr. Chairman.
Making it very concise and to the point. Thank you, Mr. Sackett. Given that, again, we will be conducting official public testimony on Senate Bill 215 very soon so that we can hopefully, if it's the will of this committee, move this bill to the next committee of referral so that it can receive the consideration that it justly deserves. Given that, I believe we'll just have a brief at ease while we get ready for the resolution. And Representative Millett, I think you're next up, but brief at ease.
Back to order. Next item before us is HJR 29. It's the BLM Legacy Oil Well Cleanup. At this time, I'd like to ask for a motion on the House Joint Resolution number 29/8.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I would move that we bring House Joint Resolution number 29 before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Okay, I'll object for purpose of discussion. Representative Millett, you have taken the seat, so you are up.
Thank you. Thank you to the committee for hearing this resolution. House Joint Resolution is a resolution that was brought forward to me actually at a dinner that I was having with some friends, and there was a young gal there, and she happened to intern with AOGCC and started to talk to me about this legacy well issue, which I had never heard of. She was inventorying the legacy wells that were drilled between 1944 and 1981 by the U.S. Navy and by the United States Geological Survey. These wells were drilled, and back in those days, to their credit, there wasn't a real good way to plug and abandon a well. There wasn't any rules or regulations until, I think, Kathy Forrester will tell us, probably in 1956. But some of those wells were drilled after 1956. So those wells, as they sit, there's 136 of them. They're spread. They're the yellow dots in that area. They're spread all over National Petroleum Reserve. Right now, those wells are in various stages of decay. Some of them are unplugged. Some of them were full of diesel. Some of them have houses and, we shouldn't say houses, but shacks and barrels that were brought up with diesel in them to continue to explore for the drilling. As it sits now, the BLM has plugged seven. Seven wells have been plugged properly. 42 wells are still flagrantly out of violation with the AOGCC rules. These wells have been we've asked as a state to have the BLM come up and clean these wells up. And what the BLM will tell you is their plan for plugging and abandonment of these wells is about one well a year. Since we started talking about that, that is the schedule that they have been on currently. These wells pose a risk not only to the pristine environment of the Arctic, but just as a risk to the ecosystem. We don't know what some of the wells even look like because, frankly, no one's been up there in a while to take a good survey. The last survey that was done in, I think, 2007. A couple of things that I'll point out of interest to these wells and why I find it imperative that they start to clean up as fast as they can is that three of the wells have been lost due to erosion, coastline erosion, and so they're missing. There's about five other wells that they can't find due to the terrain of the North Slope and the permafrost and the snow flow. There's lakes up there that now contain open wells that have no casing, that are just wide open. Kathy Forrester will tell you soon about this well called the Whistling Well. And they call it the Whistling Well because, well, it's whistling. And why it's whistling is because there's natural gas escaping from that well for the last 50 years. So when we talk about wells that are really in need of some attention, these of these wells that are 42 wells that are flagrantly out of violation, we really need the BLM and the federal government to step up to the plate. The other thing that I find amusing in a way is that as we fight every year to open ANWR, these wells and these pictures that Kathy will show you are being used on the very environmentalist websites that say that these are oil company wells. And I just want to make it clear, these aren't oil company wells. These aren't producer wells. These are the federal government wells, the U.S. Navy and the United States government's wells that were drilled. They say they're using about 17 of these wells for climate change. I will tell you, of those 17 wells that they are using for climate change, we don't know how those wells are cased. We don't know how those wells are using monitoring to climate change, if there's still diesel present. It really is disparaging to think that while we can't get a bridge to CD5, these 137 wells, well, 130 wells, sit out there exposed on the tundra to wildlife, to anybody that, you know, is out there, people that subsist out there, they run across these sites. And the hypocrisy of the federal government telling us that we can't develop because we don't know how to do it, I find it hypocritical that this is the way that they leave our land. It truly is a disgrace to Alaskans, and that we continue to allow the federal government to treat our land this way upsets me. We've met several times with the BLM here in Anchorage twice, met with the federal government, the BLM, and Department of Interior twice down in D.C. Both times I was patted on the head and said, thanks for coming, thanks for playing, we don't have any money. The same token, there's a massive project going on in D.C. in what people like to call America's front yard, which is the Mall of Monuments, and they seem to have been able to find $350 million to resod the grass. So I find it a little disheartening while we say that the money is the big issue, that they have money to do all sorts of things that aren't causing as much environmental damage as these 130 wells. We also have a situation where there was a land conveyance, a land transfer done between Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, the North Slope Borough, and the federal government. The wells that were transferred, I believe there's 33 of them, the federal government has now said in that land conveyance that the responsibility for abandoning and plugging those wells lies within the new landowner, which is not true, and I think you'll have some folks testify to that fact that that wasn't part of the agreement. We've asked them to be creative. We first asked them just to go ahead and give us all those wells and all that land, and that Alaskans would take care of it, make it state land. They didn't like that idea. We asked them to lease those areas. We've talked to producers that said that in leasing some of those areas that they would plug and abandon those wells. They said that couldn't be done. The other thing that I find ironic is that the federal government has leased land in NPRA. They've leased land in our continental shelf, and the revenues from those leases total $9 billion. So $9 billion of leasing up in the federal lands within the borders of Alaska, and they can't find 100 or 200 or 300 million to come out and abandon, plug and abandon those wells properly. If we could find the federal government, if this was a producer, if this was a private company doing this, the fines would be in excess of $40 billion. So these are wells that need attention. We've asked them to coordinate with our Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, with the state of Alaska, and again, the answer comes back every single time: we don't have money. Senator Murkowski has taken issue with this. She has sent letters to Secretary Salazar, has spoken to Secretary Salazar in her budget meetings publicly and asked him what his action plan is for Alaska. And again, he says one well a year. They've since sent me a letter and said, well, we can do three this year. So I think that with enough pressure and enough public exposure of these wells, I think there's money that we could find somewhere in the Department of Interior, in the Bureau of Land Management, that we could plug those and plug and abandon those wells properly.
So. Thank you, Representative Millett. Are there any questions for Representative Millett? Seeing none, online we have Carl Portman, Anchorage Resource Development Council. And for the committee's information, after Carl, I'm going to call him Kathy Forrester, and she'll present the PowerPoint. So go ahead, Carl.
Good afternoon. My name is Carl Portman, Deputy Director of the Resource Development Council. RDC encourages the committee to pass HJR 29, urging the federal government to plug legacy wells properly and to reclaim the legacy well sites as soon as possible. This resolution, as you have heard, has received overwhelming support in the House, where every member of the body joined in as a co-sponsor. The resolution has also received national media attention. The Department of the Interior and other federal agencies require that private companies operating in the Arctic explore for and produce domestic energy and mineral resources in an environmentally responsible manner. Through federal laws, regulations, and permitting, federal agencies have set a high bar to mitigate impacts to the environment. As a result, industry has been held to the highest standards, among the most stringent in the world. When violations to federal laws or permitting requirements occur, companies are held responsible, often facing steep fines. However, in the case of federal lands in the Arctic, the federal government has not held itself to the same standard. The U.S. Navy and the U.S. Geological Survey drilled approximately 137 wells on federal lands in northern Alaska between 1944 and 1981. All of which are now abandoned. Only a handful of the legacy wells were properly plugged and reclaimed. The remaining wells are out of compliance with regulations adopted by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The AOGCC has repeatedly reminded the federal government of the obligation to plug legacy wells and properly reclaim well sites. The state cannot impose fines on the federal government, but if it could do so, the fines would exceed $8 billion and much more if the statute of limitations were disregarded. HJR 29 points out the double standard and hypocrisy that exist in the federal government's regulation and permitting of resource development activities in Alaska. Clearly, the Department of Interior has not held itself to the same standards it demands of industry to meet in the responsible development of Alaska's resources. The resolution rightly urges the federal government to comply with the same laws and requirements it expects industry to follow. The federal government should lead by example and set even a higher standard for itself. RDC strongly encourages the committee to pass this resolution, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd also like to compliment Representative Cherise Millett for introducing this resolution. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Portman? I guess I got ahead of myself. That's public testimony, but we'll get to that in a minute. No questions. Thank you very much for coming out tonight or this afternoon, Carl. Next up would be Kathy Forrester. She'll make a PowerPoint presentation on the legacy wells. You on there, Kathy?
Yes, sir, I am.
The floor is yours.
All right. For the record, my name is Kathy Forrester. I'm the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And first, I want to thank Representative Millett and all the other legislators who have rallied around this issue and championed it in D.C. for our state. This has been something near and dear to me for years, and I've been beating my head against a brick wall and not getting anything, but nothing we're going to do about it as an answer. So let me go to the PowerPoint presentation. From 1944 to 1981, the federal government drilled numerous wells in northern Alaska. They're called legacy wells. I hope you're looking at the map right now that shows that they're all in the western North Slope in areas with geography and biology, just like ANWR. But all are in or near an area called a National Petroleum Reserve, not a National Wildlife Refuge. So the alphabet soup makes the federal government's excuses for not doing anything about it okay. Sarcasm intended. The Bureau of Land Management within the Department of Interior is the agency that operates these wells. Essentially, every one of them has been out of compliance with Alaska regulations at one time or another, and most of them still are today. In fact, given the condition of most of these wells, review of the applicable federal regulations would likely reveal that the wells are not even in compliance with the Department of Interior's own regulations. I'm just going to share with you some of the wells and some of the issues that we have with these wells. We don't have enough time in the day to go through every single one of them, but I'll hit on the most troubling ones. And since I'm not a big fan of the PowerPoints with all the words, and since these pictures speak volumes, we'll just look at pictures. So let's start looking at pictures. This picture, those, I don't know how good the quality of the projection is there, but those are not muskox. Those are rusting drums. And I assume at one time those drums had chemicals in them, but heaven knows where those chemicals are now. The Department of the Interior says that they don't have a sufficient budget to clean up this mess. They don't even have a budget to pick up these drums, but they have enough money to rent a helicopter, fly a bunch of people out here in the beautiful summertime, take pictures of them, go home and write a report about them. So if you know, as regulators for the state of Alaska, what would you guys do if I told you that BP or Exxon or any other company that we regulate had told me that they hadn't budgeted to clean up their mess, so we weren't going to make them do it? I think you'd fire me so fast my head would be spinning. Please don't fire me for this, because I don't have the authority to make the BLM clean it up. Believe me, if I did, I would. This again, want to reiterate that this is the hypocrisy of the federal government, because they're allowing this mess to exist in the same place that they're saying that they're protecting from people like Shell and Conoco, who we all know are a heck of a lot more responsible than this.
Kathy, I got a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Kathy, for the testimony. Very compelling. Why don't we have jurisdiction over the federal government on this? And could the state sue the federal government over this issue?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the feds trump the states. We don't have the ability to make them comply with our rules, and no, we can't sue them. I've been worried about this since I got here in 2005, and I've been told that the only thing I can do is embarrass them in the court of public opinion. So here we go. But that's a good question. Now, to be fair to the Alaska BLM folks, I think they'd like to clean this mess up too, but their hands are tied by the meager budget that the federal government gives to them, and they've also told me that they can't even ask for more money. They said that if we wanted to ask for more money for them, we could, but it's against the rules for them to even ask for more money for this stuff. So, I feel for the local folks, but I'm not going to give the feds any slack. They've got the money, as Representative Millett said. They've got all that money from lease sales. And when I was walking on the lawn in D.C. a couple of weeks ago and saw the renovation of the mall, pulling up all the grass and just re-sodding it so that people can walk all over it again, I thought, holy smokes, for that $350 million, they could P&A almost all of these wells. So let's look at some more pictures. Let's turn to the next picture. In Alaska, proper plugging and abandonment of wells is governed by Article 2 of our regulations, and the purpose of properly plugging and abandoning the wells includes a number of things: public safety, protection of the environment, and protection of sources of drinking water. So, you know, rhetorical question again, how many of you would like a drink of this water? Hold your laughter. But, okay, we'll move to the next picture. Proper plugging and abandonment of wells includes sufficient downhole cement and plugs to ensure that underground fluids cannot migrate. With very few exceptions, the 137 legacy wells do not comply with this requirement. And the well that you're looking at in this picture is open to the surface with no downhole plugs in it and no wellhead on it. Several of the wells like this one were left filled with diesel when the federal government left them. I think this is one of those wells, and I just wonder where that diesel has gone over all of this time. Moving to the next picture, proper plugging and abandonment of wells requires that all underground pipe be cut off 5 feet below ground level so that it cannot create an excavation hazard or become a problem during subsidence or other normal earth movement. With few exceptions, again, none of the legacy wells complies with this requirement. You've probably seen this picture in a mailer or fundraiser opposing development of ANWR, and the oil industry was blamed for it. So we've got to get this problem fixed. It's not doing our state any good. Looking at the next picture, proper plugging and abandonment of a well requires sufficient surface remediation that the site blends in with the natural vegetation. Again, laughter, please hold. Within a few seasons, there should be no surface indication of the well's location. Many of the legacy well sites are permanent eyesores like this one, littered with rotting wood, rusting metal, and other debris. And there's that helicopter that they can afford to rent, although they can't afford to come in and clean up these wells. Because the legacy wells have not been properly plugged, the few wells that have been revegetated are potentially more serious downhole mechanical issues because, although they're out of sight and out of mind, they're not secure. So they're little time bombs waiting to go off. Another thing about this picture is it reminds us that they don't have the money to plug it, but they sure can come out and take pictures of it. And it's our tax dollars at work. Looking at the next picture, delaying the plugging and abandonment of the wells has already, as Representative Millett said, caused several of the wells to be lost, some due to subsidence and other normal earth movement. And the BLM has taken these wells off of their concern list since they can no longer find them. And as I said, out of sight and out of mind doesn't mean out of trouble. Two wells are at the bottom of subsidence and snowmelt lakes, and a third has been buried by a landslide. Additional wells can simply no longer be found with no explanation for why. And postponing the abandonment of the remaining wells puts them at risk of becoming lost also. The well shown here is on its way to being lost as this subsidence lake develops. Looking at the next picture, here's another well that's well on its way to becoming lost. And just imagine how expensive it will be to remediate this well once it's completely submerged under a lake and they don't even know where it is anymore. But with the current approach, the cost will become zero because they won't care about it anymore. Looking at the next picture, allowing these safe and unsightly wells to litter Alaska's wilderness while threatening both human safety and the environment is unacceptable. Nonetheless, the BLM has properly plugged and abandoned only about 7 of the 137 legacy wells. Now, again, if these wells were operated by an oil company, the AOGCC would force compliance with our regulations and we would impose severe fines for noncompliance, but we do not have the authority to do that with the federal government. Moving on to the next picture. We shouldn't have to force the federal government into compliance. They should provide adequate funding specifically designated for the purpose of bringing these wells into regulatory compliance with our regulations as well as their own. And where would that funding come from? You know, everyone knows that we're tight on money. But, you know, the billions of dollars that they've collected in lease sales, perhaps some of the stimulus monies that were collected a few years ago. Just remember back to the Macondo disaster when they suspended all operations in the Gulf of Mexico? Wouldn't it have been nice if some of those displaced and unemployed Gulf of Mexico oilfield workers had been sent up to Alaska to plug and abandon these wells? I mean, I could go on. Maybe they wouldn't fix the mall in time for the next inauguration. So that enough of that. When I made this presentation to the Groundwater Protection Council a few months ago, as I showed each picture to them, I asked them, everyone in the audience, they were regulators from state and federal agencies, including the EPA and the BLM, members of those organizations in the audience. And as I showed each picture, I asked anyone in the room who thought that the wells were in compliance to stand up. No one, even the BLM representatives, stood for any of the pictures. I don't have anything else to add, but I will be available for questions. And again, I thank you all for taking time to listen. This is near and dear to my heart.
Question by Senator Pascban.
Thank you, Kathy, for the awesome presentation. Is there a rough estimate of the cost to make these 130 wells safe or compliant?
Senator Pascan, through the chair, the estimate that I've heard is $500 million, but I suspect that there are ways that it could be done cheaper, and we have attempted to discuss some of those ways with the BLM. For example, oil companies have offered, if you give us the lease for these lands, we will plug and abandon them for you for free. There goes a lot of cost. Another thing that would reduce the cost substantially is, you know, the BLM picks one or two wells a year, flies in and cleans up that one well and leaves. And as you know, a majority or a large portion of the cost is the mobilization and demobilization of the equipment. And if they were to move that equipment up there and do more than one well at a time, there would be enormous economies of scale of doing more than one and one mobilization and demobilization every time they do a well and everyone a new season. So there are ways that we could reduce those costs, but the number that I've heard estimated is $500 million or less, I would add.
Additional questions of Commissioner Forster? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is appropriate for Kathy or somebody else, but I just can't believe this is not some sort of violation of federal law. I have a hard time believing that there's not some EPA violation or Superfund violation. Do you know if our attorneys have looked at this or your attorneys have looked at this to see if we can compel them to fix this?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, they have. No, we can't. I even talked to the head of the EPA Crimes Division, and he assured me that since it happened more than 5 years ago, it's not a crime. The statute of limitations has expired. That was supposed to be a pathetic joke. But you can tell I'm really frustrated with this. But the EPA would love to help us out, but they can't figure out what to do.
Senator Pascman.
If Alaska were to spend the money to clean it up and make it safe and compliant, is there any way that can be attached or we could hold on to some federal royalty dollars so that they don't leave when the land was developed?
Senator Pascan, through the chair, I'm not an attorney, but in all of my efforts with our Attorney General's office, they haven't offered me anything like that as a possible solution.
Further questions? See no further questions. We're going to go to public testimony at this time, and I'd like the record to reflect that we've already received public testimony from Mr. Portman. So that reflected on the record. Next person for public testimony is David Terrio. Are you online?
I'm in the room, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. There you go.
For the record, David Terrio representing the Alaska Conservation Alliance. The Conservation Alliance does support this resolution. We appreciate Representative Miller for bringing it forward. Frankly, it's an issue we knew very little about before Representative Miller's office approached us. We want to find a creative solution for this problem. Kathy Forster's Forrester's presentation is a very persuasive piece that this is an issue that needs to be taken care of for generations of Alaskans to come. Our concern is to see, protect the environment and protect human health, and we think this is a risk. So we would also like to see consistent rules consistently applied for private entities and government entities, and we think this is a problem. So we support Representative Millett, we support all the House members that have signed on, and we hope there will be a solution found shortly.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question. The Alaska Conservation Alliance should be fairly well in touch with a lot of other conservation groups, and maybe we could use your help to get those groups involved in this and get some pressure put on the federal government, because it seems like every time we turn around, we're lacking support in this. And who would be more interested in getting this cleaned up than the conservation groups themselves, especially since we heard Kathy Forrester say that this is one photo they used to come out against having us explore in Anwar. So what do you think about taking that on for a little project?
Well, thanks for putting me on the spot. No, certainly we do. You know, this is an issue that was kind of brought forward to the Alaskan conservation community, and we're starting to learn about it, and certainly we are starting to talk about it with some of the national organizations that we know. And if calling them and having them get on board and talk to some of their contacts with federal agencies to make solve this problem one way or another, I think we'd be happy to do that.
Be happy to have your help. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, is there anybody else online? I don't think there is. Nobody else online? Anybody else in Juneau wish to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing at this time. This time I'd like to offer an amendment called Amendment Number 1. Everybody should have that amendment in their packet. And it's a pretty simple amendment. And I'm going to just tell people what I plan to do if I can. And I've asked other people to do the same. At the time the legislature was given a doubling of their office accounts, I refused to accept mine. But I'm pursuing at this time get that money diverted to help in this cause that this amendment does. Basically, is what the amendment does is ask the governor to and his office to become involved in this resolution process and hopefully get them to buy PR in certain newspapers and maybe go so far as to have an array of photos shown there versus what the photo of a real, truly abandoned well that's abandoned by the regulations that the oil companies have to abandon a well in the state of Alaska. That way we can get a reasonable photo array of abandoned wells that are abandoned properly in Alaska. And if we could do that and establish a fund, I think it would have a major effect on what the feds would be able to do to answer this. So with that, I just offer the amendment and be happy to answer any questions on it.
What's the bill sponsor's thoughts on the amendment?
I'll let her say.
Thank you, Chairman Pascavan. I welcome the resolution or the amendment. I think that I had Jeff from my office do some research on what it would cost to take out an ad, a full-page ad, black and white, in the Washington Post while Congress is in session. Just to put a little more heat on it, they range anywhere from $54,000 up to $110,000. So I think that the impression of doing one ad would probably give us a lot of publicity thereafter in earned media just from having the exposure in one full-page ad in one publication somewhere. I chose the Washington Post just because the headquarters for the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Land Management is in Washington, D.C., and most of the people that hold the purse strings for the BLM and DOI reside there during session also. I support the amendment fully.
And I'll just say one thing. If we can't get the money together to do it in a newsprint, the Internet's a huge weapon nowadays. And so if we could do it with an Internet, say start a mailing to through email to every member of every conservation club in the United States, that might work too. So anyway, that's what we plan to pursue, and we'll see what we can do. That's why I offered the amendment. Senator French.
Thanks. And it looks like it's language sort of designed to coax the governor, convince the governor it's a good idea. I don't see like a shall and must, so you're trying to avoid a fiscal note, but it's just saying this is a good idea. Right.
And if there's any money
without actually coming,
I tried to meet with them before I came down here today, but time was limited. But
you can do a lot without money, and
yeah, you can. And I think this is one. If we can get the help of the conservation community, it may be to our benefit.
I think it's a good alliance. Thank you.
Okay. Any objections to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment's approved. With that, we have in front of us House Joint Resolution number 29 as a backslash A as amended. What's the pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Joint Resolution number 29 version backslash A as amended by amendment number 1 from this committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and no attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, bill will move. Resources is adjourned.